imagine a world in which post-traumatic stress no longer robs from millions who suffer.
You don't want to get help because you're embarrassed. You don't want to tell people the dark stuff that you've went through.
That stigmatism of you can't talk to people, it is so true.
Post-traumatic stress is not a disorder. It's an injury that can be healed quickly so that those who suffer get back to thriving in their families, communities, and mission.
And I said, I don't want to live this trauma again. Right. And he goes, You don't have to. Yeah. And I said, What?
The hospital I went to and the experts, they forgot to tell me I can heal. I didn't know that I can get rid of PTSD.
Each week, we tell a skeptical world what is possible with stories of those who have successfully cured their trauma.
I don't even know what to imagine for myself now, my future, because I have one.
This is Life After PTSD. Well, I want to welcome everybody to another episode of Life After PTSD. My name is Jeff McLaughlin, your host, and with me on the line today, as so often, my buddy, my friend, Alan Canerva in Guelph, Ontario. How's it going, man?
Really, really well, Jeff. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Y'all snowing up there? What do you got going on up there right now, man?
Please, it's still summer here.
I had some breeze yesterday and I was happy. So I walked outside and said, man, it's going to be a good day. It's going to be a good day. So maybe that summer's over. Hey, man, interesting topic today. You know, in the work of what we do, we are, you know, we're unapologetic about what we believe, that PTSD is not an illness, that it's an injury that can be cured, that can be healed. And I know that it takes some time for people to get on board with that. That is a paradigm shift for so many people who are getting into our world. And so for many of them, they come on board because they experience the healing themselves. They go through a protocol treatment and they get cleared and they go, man, I didn't believe it was possible. I mean, Alan, my journey was like that. Just, I saw something that I couldn't unsee, as I've said many times to you before. But then there are some that vocalize the dissension, the skepticism, however you would put it. And I thought it would be a great episode just to hit that stuff head on, man, with you, and just to go, let's address those questions. Let's address the naysayers, not to be belligerent, okay, but to acknowledge, first of all, that we appreciate their skepticism and that we are selling more than snake oil here, man. Would that be a good topic for today?
I think that's a great topic, and I think you're absolutely right that healthy skepticism is required. We don't want people being led down the wrong path, if you will. But where we are today is so substantiated that we just need to get the word out.
So, man, you got an email recently, and we're not going to use names, of course. We would never want to shame someone on air. We'd actually thank someone for reaching out. I, Alan, I think there's that old, what is the old adage that says, any press is good press. You know, I think in our world, it's any contact is good contact, because even with the dissenters, there's an opportunity. And we've taken those opportunities many times before to really help educate and correct on things. So even though we might get a little antagonistic with some of the bullet points in the email, I know that we mean this in the best of spirits here, that we want to address the concerns. So you want to jump into that? You want to pull that thing out and we'll talk about what was said to you? You got one of those, you know, wonderful emails the other day, huh?
Well, it's interesting. There, I think we should step back a bit, if we could, Jeff, and look at what seems to be the emergence of nonprofits, ostensibly started and led by military, first responders, police, or firefighters, and that in and of itself has to be a message to the healthcare system that something's not right. When you have these people ostensibly going out of their own comfort zone to create entities to support people. And when you talk to them, the message is always the same. When you look at their websites, they're in business. They start their NGOs and they fundraise and it becomes their passion to help people get appropriate treatment. And you see it everywhere. And it's reminiscent. I listened to Romeo Dallaire speak shortly after Rwanda in 1994 out at the University of British Columbia. And he said, you know, in a conflict zone in the 80s, you might have to deal with one or two or three nonprofits, NGOs, non-governmental organizations working in conflict zones. But by 1994, there were over 200 international NGOs that descended into Rwanda. And he was talking about the challenge of working with them, because although they were well-intended, they were supplying medical supplies, food, water to villages during the genocide. He said as soon as the NGOs pulled out of the community, the rebel forces, the antagonistic forces would grab the food, water, and medical supplies. So literally the NGOs to a degree were supplying the combatants. And I draw that metaphor to where we are today. You see this explosion of nonprofits. Now, you and I have friends that are doing it, right? We have the Millsaps in North Carolina have started one. You know, our friend Dan Jarvis has one. And just around me, in the communities around me, I see three or four brand new ones that are starting operations in 2020. So I reached out to one earlier this week. And I said, you know, I said, here's who I am. Here's what we do. Here is what the NLP, the trauma-focused NLP protocol, can do for people, the success rates. And I said, I'd like to connect. And he wrote back an email to me, right? And he said, thanks for reaching out to us. I went on your website, and I'm impressed and curious about it. If this injury can be healed, then why is it a big secret from everyone? And that struck me. Why is it a big secret from everyone? And he's right. It is a big secret. And I think we're at that place. So on the supply side, supply of services, we have this explosion of nonprofits, small nonprofits, all competing for a share. In the United States, it's rampant. The number of vet-led nonprofits is exploding. And yet when you see what programs they're bringing in an ideology of, and I'm quoting this email, but we hear it repetitively, there are a few NGOs that are saying, look, there's a solution that can help people overcome trauma quickly. And in this email from this gentleman, he says, my organization is a not-for-profit to help first responders and veterans heal, but it takes a lot of time and self-care to do so. Learning different coping mechanisms, learning how to live your new life, and learning that it is okay not to be okay are our fundamentals. And so this is such a radical departure for where we live. We're not teaching coping skills. We're not teaching people to say, I'm broken forever. Our mantra, our position is that trauma is post-traumatic stress is an injury. It's your brain's perfect reaction in an abnormal situation that continues to run amok. And it's an injury that can heal. And we have the research data to prove it. You know, Dr. Frank Bork's organization has done an incredible job at defining the NLP protocol. You know, and we had Dr. Richard Gray on early. I think it was episode 26 or something. And he described the process of bringing these NLP experts together to define a protocol, the best of NLP, which Dr. Bork and his research group renamed, they relabeled the RTM. And then they researched it, and there's a 92% success rate. So this is such a beautiful dilemma, if you will. The problem is big. The solution, a very credible, highly effective solution is present, but there's both resistance and a lack of awareness that it exists.
Alan, I right away, the thing that jumps to mind is, you know, in the United States of America, we have an opioid epidemic that's of unbelievable proportions. And so many of the people who are dying from drug overdoses, who are getting heavily addicted to these opioids, are, we'll just start with one of the biggest segments of the people that we work with on a regular basis, which is our vets. And one of the reasons that it's a crisis, the story not long ago about the Purdue Pharma company that was heavily tied with these sorts of things, that were manufacturers of many of these drugs, and family members who had moved hundreds of millions, maybe even billions, to offshore accounts, declared bankruptcy when lawsuits were thrown at them, and are basically going to face no repercussions for their, you know, involvement in this process. We have a problem here. We've been feeding pills. There's a lot of things I think that are working against that idea of bringing healing and bringing a cure to PTSD as well. Would you agree with that?
Well, of course I would. And by its inclusion in the DSM-5, the diagnostic manual, as a disorder, and the symptomology of it, puts it in the realm of medical. And when you look at the dollars expended on post-traumatic stress, when you look at people like we've had on the show, Kyle Lundy, 350 milligrams of Zoloft a day. 350 milligrams of Zoloft a day, 150 milligrams over the therapeutic limit, the price point of that alone, and let's just guesstimate that there's 50,000 people on Zoloft, 100,000 people. I don't know the stats.
Who knows? Oh, it's got to be more than that. It's got to be more than that.
So think of that price point. And for people to be on Zoloft long term, now he was on it for eight or so years, I believe. There has to be an ideology, a belief structure, a messaging that PTSD is difficult, if not impossible, to overcome. And again, referring to Dan Jarvis, who is PTSD free, you know, we have it on video, him being treated, him being, treatment's the wrong word, but going through the protocol in front of an audience and being PTSD free. Dan, when he goes to his VA psychiatrist to get his diagnosis removed, he doesn't want to be diagnosed as having PTSD anymore, because he doesn't, by every statistically accurate test, whether it's a PSSI-5 or CAPS-5 that the VA use, he's PTSD-free. His VA psychiatrist smiled at him, laughed at him, if you will, and said, well, first, people don't ask me to do that. And second, you'll lose your pension. And third, it's not possible because PTSD can't be cured.
Hmm.
That, you know, we're looking the problem square in the eyes. So that's the VA doctor who comes from a thought process, a position, if you will, based on information from 30, 40, 50 years ago. And the technologies that they're using, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and prolonged exposure, are literally decades behind it. And it's not that the people who created it were ill-intended. It's not the people who are using it are ill-intended. It would be the equivalent of me giving you a brick mobile phone and saying, hey, Jeff, why don't you use the phone? You can make phone calls on it. Why do you, you know, why use anything else? You know, the iPhone 10, it's not really been researched.
Hmm.
You know, that metaphorically, that's what we're doing. We're using a phone from the 1990s, a brick phone, when we could be using a next-gen Samsung or iPhone. And then there's the residential care centers. The people who are running 6, 8, 10, 12-week programs for overcoming PTSD and to teach coping skills. You know, where I live in my community, there's one that's fairly well known internationally. And the rumor on the street from fairly credible sources say they charge $50,000 for an 8-week stay. And the average person has multiple 8-week stays with them.
Hmm.
They don't want to hear that there's a way to overcome PTSD in, you know, under 5 hours or 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That business model doesn't fly. So they're getting research grants from the government, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. Their latest one is called General Task Management, GTM. And I was at their poster session, and their poster session for this research they did into GTM, General Task Management for people suffering from PTSD. It just the letter, the titles, everything makes my blood boil. And I talked to the young PhD candidate who was, you know, it was her research project. And I said, you know, did you test for PTSD? She said, yeah, we did a test at the beginning. I believe they use CAPS-5. I'm not 100% sure. Or PCL-5. And I said, did you test after the people went through your program that your program alleviated any of the trauma? She said, no, we weren't testing for that. We weren't testing to see if it had any impact on their level of traumatization. We did test on whether they could handle tasks better. And they received $600,000 in grants to do that. So instead of dealing with the issue, the trauma, they're getting injections of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to test coping skill training. And then they're getting the government to send firefighters, police, military, EMS people into their center to learn coping skills. They don't want to hear about a solution in 6 hours or less.
Does it make your head spin just knowing that?
And that's not – hey, and this isn't conspiracy, okay?
Well, and that's the thing. We don't talk conspiracy theories around here. I think you and I are, you know, are the kinds of people and the guests that we have on here that are the ones that kind of generally acknowledge there are some wackos out there that purport some, you know, some really fantastical ideas that we would not get on board with or something like that. I know that we have skeptical minds and, you know, very much approach these subjects wanting real evidence. I know that that's how you operate your clinic, you know, Alan, and all that. I find it amazing that, you know, we can be labeled at times, you know, the whack jobs or the weather, you know, saying these kinds of things when the signs are so blatantly obvious, you know, some of these markers are so blatantly obvious for why we are in an uphill battle. I mean, the institutions and powers that be that we are, and it's not just that, as you know, it's not just, you know, these clinics and the government dollars and everything. We're also facing, you know, an amazing backlash that comes at times from, I think, even the clinical community, right? The therapists, the community of therapists and counselors out there. Some are amazing, but some who are highly resistant. I've been 30 years trained in this. I've never heard of something like this. You can't do this. All you can do is cope. Yada, yada, yada. I will never forget our experience down in Winter Haven. Remember, you had the gentleman. How mad was he? I wish I had known this. How did I not know this? I've been in this business for how long? And it took him seeing it.
Dr. Ken, I remember that so well, Jeff, because the demonstration that I did where he had that epiphany was quite challenging at the front of the room.
Yeah.
Energetically challenging. And so at the end of it, I went outside just to sort of recharge my batteries out in the sun. The demo was amazingly successful, but it was energetically draining. And when I walked back in, Dr. Ken was sitting in the hall, and I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, Ken," and he looked up and he was beet red.
Yeah.
And he said, "I am so angry." And I thought, wow, what did I say? How did I offend him? I said, "Ken, what's up? What happened here?" He said, "Exactly what you said. Why didn't I know this? I've been part of a SISM team for 10 years. And, you know, people come in my office and I do what I do. I do my trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. I do my talk therapy. And I think they go away, okay. But then, you know, 2 days later, they come back and they've had two bad nights, right? And so we've seen that over and over again, though. You know, our good friend Carrie Russo was skeptical. And she came to the first training. And, of course, you know where she lives now, right?
Yeah.
She's 100% in. Cindy, who works in that same office. I haven't talked to Cindy for a bit, but last Christmas when I talked to her, she had already worked with 30 people.
Yeah.
And by January, her numbers were up close to 50.
Yeah.
So at the pace she's working with, I suspect she's worked with 100 people successfully with trauma. I should actually reach out to her.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's repetitive. It's hard to get people in the room, but once they're in the room, they go, "Oh my God. Why aren't we being taught this?" And again, it's the systemic challenges, and I like to draw metaphors to it so that people don't feel, so they understand the systemic challenges. And I go back to the period 1979, 1980, 81, where two Australian doctors discovered that about 80% of stomach ulcers were related to a bacteria, and that if they treated it with antibiotics, the ulcers went away. At that moment in time, if you got a stomach ulcer, that was yours for life. It was an illness that you would deal with for life on medication with all the discomforts, and it would flare up and down, but it was a thing for life. You had ulcers. And those researchers were poo-pooed, were put down, were vilified by both the medical community, Jeff, and the big pharma for over a decade. The one doctor, Barry Marshall, actually infected himself with the bacteria and developed ulcers and then treated himself. You know, fast forward, so they start out in 79-ish. I believe it was 79 they did this discovery. In 2003, they get a Nobel award, a Nobel Prize for medicine, for their discovery that stomach ulcers can be caused by bacterial infection. 24 years later.
All right. I'll see you in 24 years, Alan. Like,
thank you.
And you know what? And I know we're in it for the long haul, and we have to be fighting up against those institutions. Hey, man, I want to take a break here, and I want you to be thinking as we come back after the break. I want you to be thinking of the three biggest questions that you get asked, whether it's from a therapist or from a client or whatever. And I'm talking about the resistant, skeptical ones. What are the three biggest things that you get asked, or the three biggest challenges posed to you as you are unapologetic in what you're saying about PTSD as an injury rather than an illness? Okay, so have a thought about that. When we come back, we're going to hit on those three questions. Stick with us, listen to some words from our sponsors, and we'll see you after the break.
Hey, Life After PTSD listeners. We're glad that you love other stories of healing, but what about you? First Orlando Counseling is the premier trauma therapy center in Central Florida with a full staff of trained clinicians ready to help you clear your trauma without re-traumatization. Childhood abuse, relationship abuse, a traumatic car accident, birth trauma, first responder or military trauma, even phobias. You don't have to live like this. It's time for you to heal. Schedule a consultation today by visiting firstorlandocounseling.com or call 407-514-4470. It's that easy.
So here we are after the break. Jeff McLaughlin hosting, Alan Kinnerva on the line here talking Life After PTSD, a conversation about skeptics, objections, and what it means to push up against the institution. Alan, we've been talking about why, as you received an email from an objector, if you will, or a skeptic. Again, no disrespect meant by that. You had someone that reached out to you and said, well, why this message that you preach that PTSD is simply an injury and it can be cured, why isn't this a common knowledge? Why isn't this in the masses? We've been talking about that, and I thought it would be good for us to address three objections, three questions you commonly hear from those skeptics, the three biggest things that they generally say to you in light of your message. Do you have three that kind of spring readily to mind?
Yeah, the first one, I think you hit it right on the head, is this concept, as the writer said, this big secret. And it's a big secret because if you go into the psychology schools where they teach, or the social work schools, the master's programs, if you look at what they teach disorder, illness-based interventions. You know, if you go into the cognitive behavioral therapy, they'll tell you you probably need 26, anywhere from 24 to 30 sessions, one every week or every 2 weeks. If you go into prolonged exposure, they're going to say another number, whatever it is. If you do EMDR, they're going to say another number. But it's all fairly long-tailed, if you will. And so this new understanding of the mind, and again, using my metaphor, telephones, the understanding of the brain and what's happening in the brain and how emotions are created, these are brave new worlds. This is an exploding understanding. You know, you've had Dr. Ben on, and we talked about Bruce Lipton, the cellular biologist, stem cell biologist, and his understanding that our thoughts, our beliefs, our energy impacts our biology. This is all, you know, leading edge research. And when you go into academia and look at what they're actually teaching, they're not teaching the leading edge in the psychology schools. And I think the big secret is how do you combat that? Because everybody has a psychology, a social work school, right? So, you know, that objection, why the big secret? And you know, and let's give credit where credit's due. People like Dr. Bork are phenomenal researchers. But it's people like us who are getting the message out, right? Who are getting the message out. So that's one. That's a big objection. And the other is this this acceptance when you get a diagnosis, that's what you have, and it is that way. And again, I mentioned Dr. Ben because this is his platform, right? But it's not only Dr. Ben's. If you look at the work of Wim Hof, the Dutch guy who challenges us that we've given up our immune system to the medical system, and he trains people to reconnect to their capacity to heal. So we have this group of people that when they go to the doctor and the doctor says, you're broken, they just accept they're broken. Dr. Perlmutter, on PBS talks about that, that, you know, in his research called Power Up the Brain, he talks about people coming in his clinic and getting a diagnosis that they had stage 4 cancer and they had 90 days to live and they pass away within 90 days. And then other people, and this is what's fascinated him, other people get the same diagnosis. They come back in 90 days and they're cancer-free. And the medical system has no explanation for that other than a spontaneous remission. So we have this massive resistance in people. Once they get the diagnosis, they take it on. And often they take it on at as identity level. It starts becoming their identity. I have PTSD. And, you know, I think, you know, having spent quite a bit of time with Dan and Kyle and Craig and Shane and a bunch of other people with PTSD, that, you know, you talked to Craig on that last podcast with Craig, letting go of that identity allowed him the opportunity to grow and heal, right? Because when we met him, he had PTSD. He just kept telling you. Kyle had given up, literally given up. He had PTSD. He didn't go out. When he did, he, you know, the 1 week trivia thing at the pub, he'd sit with his back to the wall.
Yep.
40 pounds overweight, no relationships. And now look at him. 8 months later, and we'll have him on the next podcast, but 8 months later, he's in a relationship. He's lost 30 pounds. I see him on Facebook singing and playing his guitar. You know, he posted the other day that he was cooking dinner for his girlfriend, his partner. And I said, boy, you need to start a podcast, right? Kyle's Kitchen.
Seriously. Yeah. I think I know a guy could do it for him too. That's,
I do. Are we going to gratuitously plug you now?
Yeah, no. Well, you know, why not? No, but actually I was just thinking, I was like, I'm waiting for the day I'm going to turn on Jeopardy and Kyle's going to be a contestant on there and he's going to go for a streak, man. He's going to be like the next Ken Jennings or something crazy.
He's a brilliant guy. He has the brain. And then, so that's two. And then the other biggest one is that just the speed. Think about it. Think about this. You know, you are a person who wears your uniform proudly. Let's talk about not the civilian population who gets PTSD, which the numbers are staggering, but let's talk about people in uniform or as people like to call them, the oath takers, as opposed to the background civilian population where the numbers of trauma is extraordinary. But let's just talk about the oath takers and position this resistance to trauma-focused NLP. And so you put on a uniform, you take an oath, you have the camaraderie of everybody you serve with. You serve. When you put on a uniform, you're now serving. And you're doing your job, and in the course of that job, you get hurt, you get injured, you get traumatized. Now, if you break your leg, they'll get a cast on, they'll get you back to work, right? If you need glasses, they'll get your glasses, get you back to work. But now you get a disorder, a mental disorder, and you're stigmatized. And let's say that disorder finally grows and debilitates you to the point where you can't work anymore. And they put you on short term or medium term. And ultimately, if you don't get better, long-term disability. So now you're the former uniform person who now has PTSD. That's your identity. And now you live and go through that period of your life. And there's often carnage. People lose partners, lose wives, lose family, lose their assets, lose everything, lose their life, lose their passions. So imagine you did this uniform service, which you could no longer do. And now you have this new life as the person with PTSD and there's carnage all around you. And then you meet somebody like me who says, I can help you heal your PTSD in 6 hours. There's got to be some resistance to say, where were you 10 years ago? And I can't deal with that. I can't help that. But there's just, I experience it every day in our practice, Jeff. I experience it on the street. You know, it defies logic. Everybody would say, no, a person with PTSD wants to get over it. Well, you shouldn't presuppose you know what it's like to have PTSD for 10 or 12 or 20 years, or like the people from Vietnam or the Korean War. You shouldn't presuppose what that's like. And when you look in your rearview mirror, the carnage that's behind you, the broken relationships, the lost opportunities. And now we saw that with Kim Krawcheck. When we cleared her personal trauma and then the trauma of the shooting in Parkland.
Agreed.
She was angry. She was angry at the cost to her life. She was angry at how she had treated loved ones because of her trauma. And that had to be released and heal from as well. So these are the three biggest, I think, that, you know, if we advocated and got through what we're doing, that would, if we solve these three, you know, problems, if you will, we would be so far down the road. And that's why we're doing the Life After PTSD workshop. You know, the inaugural one is coming up on November 1st here at Guelph, Ontario. And literally, we're opening the doors. Now, all due respect to people like Dr. Bork, Dr. Bork and his group are part of the systemic problem from my point of view. They have taken what was widely out in NLP, and again, I refer back to Dr. Gray's description of how it came together. It emanated from NLP people, Steve Andreas to Richard Gray, and under Frank's leadership, they found these bright lights that documented it, and they manualized it, and now they're trying to patent it. You patent things because you want to own them. You don't patent things because you want it widely distributed for the public consumption. You patent things so it can be exclusive. And then they want to put it in the realm of academia, you know, so that PhDs or master's students. And I was so encouraged to hear that they're opening some of their trainings to people, to peer support workers. Because as you and I know, it was only a short time ago, 6-8 months ago, then they were adamant that that would never happen. That unless you were a master's degree or higher in a mental health field, you would not have the privilege of learning their NLP-based protocol. And to me, that's a problem. So our workshop that's coming up is open to everybody. So if you're interested in trauma, please come to the workshop. If you support somebody with trauma, come to the workshop. If you have trauma, come to the workshop. If you're a peer support person, come to the workshop. And if you're a clinician, come to the workshop.
Alan, you forgot one.
And who's
that? And if you're a naysayer, like you
come
have
to the workshop.
Come to the workshop, right? Which is, and yeah. that's the thing that I think is cool about this is that there's nothing to hide here, right? Like this, like you said, this information should be public, and it needs to be public for the skeptics. Nobody wants to sit there and, you know, a lot of times when you're selling the snake oil or whatever, you block that person. You know, on social media that brings the criticism or whatever. You know, don't respond to the emails. You whatever. I know that we hit these things head on, and just like you have with this one that you got this week, and said, hey, here's an invitation, right? Come see, come learn, you know, keep an open mind. And what's been amazing is we've seen so many times, time and time again, you know, we've seen those who have come skeptic, myself being one of them, right? Who had a paradigm shift, had a belief change about what PTSD is, or PTSD is. Well, you know what? I didn't misspeak there, that it is PTS, right?
Yeah.
And that it can be healed.
Veterans of all uniforms specifically want the name changed to PTSI.
Absolutely.
Post-traumatic stress injury.
Absolutely.
That single thing, we know the power of words. That single act, turning a disorder / illness into an injury, that single act will change everything.
Well, I think that's one of the action steps or the action calls for our listeners. You know, we are so grateful for the audience we have, that we know that there's a consistent, just faithful audience that is a great support to the show. And guys, we get asked the question sometimes, how can we support you guys? How can we be involved? And, you know, two ways I would say right away that come to mind. First of all, share these episodes. We always tell you that, you know, but be a part of, you know, acknowledging that when you share these messages, you're changing the narrative. Right, you have a tribe, you have a sphere of influence, you have people in your family and your, you know, your neighborhoods, wherever, your workplaces that have PTS. And I believe that the more that you're having these conversations and you're helping to educate, you are helping us change the narrative overall. And so your role is not insignificant by any stretch of the imagination. And that's why I always say, we say, join us on the mission, right? Join us on the mission. So what do you think, Mr. Kernerva? How do we land this plane?
Well, let me wrap it up like this, if I could, Jeff. You know, you can list the therapies that are being used for people with PTSD and that have been researched. The fact that the NLP-based protocol is now evidence-based and it's included in the leading journal of evidence-based protocols is proof of that. And if you look at all those, if you looked at prolonged exposure with under 40% success and high recurrence rates and just painful to go through, if you look at trauma-focused CBT with the best research I've seen, at around 40%, accelerated resolution therapy had some results where they were up at around 60%, I believe. But nothing comes close to the TF-NLP, the trauma-focused NLP, as it's been researched at over 90% success rate with a year out, no, as Dr. Gray pointed out, a year out, no recurrence. And so, you know, if something comes up that's better, if there's something comes up that's 100% successful or 96% successful tomorrow, I'm all over it. But if in that, I'm going to have some criteria. Is it as effective? Is it as quick, brief, if you will? Is it as non-traumatizing, and is it drug-free? Because what we know about the brain and why we know the trauma-focused NLP works is so clean and effective for the client that I'm hard to imagine a protocol. I haven't heard anything, and we're pretty active in scouring the internet for new upcoming things. And so until something better comes along, this is 2 or 2.5 times better than anything out there. And for the people who are, you know, looking for government grants to research things like deep brain stimulation, there was $1.25 million grant given to a hospital here in Southern Ontario to research deep brain stimulation. So they install a device inside your brain. It takes surgeons to do it. The risks are, you know, strokes, death, paralysis from this procedure. Probably cost $50,000 to have the device installed in your head. And the government gave them $1.25 million to research it. It'll be 5 years from now to, you know, when it comes out, whether it had any impact at all. When you know what we know, Jeff, you and me and the groups that work with us now, how can you justify that? How can anybody be okay with that?
I think we ought to leave that as a rhetorical question. And I want to thank everybody for listening. Guys, every Monday we drop a new episode. We will always commit to bring you our best, to bring you the best guests, the best information, and we will catch you next week on Life After PTSD. We're so grateful that you listened to the show today. Now imagine a new normal you get to decide with all its possibilities once you are free of PTSD, because that is what is possible. You're here, which means you're ready, but listening alone will not heal you or those you know who are suffering. Join us on the mission to eradicate PTSD by reaching out to lifeafterptsd.org or in Canada, lifeafterptsd.ca, or by sharing this message of hope with someone you know.